Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Jason Zero for David Dubin. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The aggravated identity theft statute requires a 2-year prison sentence stacked on top of a defendant's sentence for a predicate crime. The question in this case is whether David Dubin committed aggravated identity theft when he put patient L's name and Medicaid ID number on a claim for reimbursement that the jury found was fraudulent, not because it misrepresented patient L's identity, but because it misrepresented the value of services performed or the date of service. More broadly, the question is whether a defendant automatically commits aggravated identity theft every time he commits a fraud that involves someone else's name. The answer is clearly no. A defendant commits aggravated identity theft in connection with an underlying fraud only when part of that fraud involves misrepresenting or misappropriating someone else's identity. In the healthcare context, when the fraud is about the identity of the provider or of the patient, as Judge Elrod suggested, when the defendant misrepresents the who, not the when or the why or the how much. Four features of the aggravated identity theft statute require it to be interpreted in this limited way. First, everyone agrees that the word use has multiple meanings, but the only meaning that makes sense in this context is that the use be instrumental to the fraud. This is the same definition of use that the government argued to the Supreme Court in Van Buren, a case with a similar interpretive issue. Here, the fraud involved misrepresenting when services were performed or how much they were worth, not misrepresenting or misappropriating patient L's identity. The use was incidental, not instrumental. Second, this conclusion is especially apparent when additional statutory context, the during and in relation to language, is considered. This language confirms that the use of the identity and the underlying fraud must be meaningfully connected. That connection is present when the underlying fraud itself involves misrepresenting someone's identity, but it's not present when the defendant lies about something else entirely and just happens to say or write someone else's name in the process. The healthcare cases cited by both sides track this distinction. Third, the defendant must use another person's identity without lawful authority. This language means what it says. The use must be without authority that is lawfully given. The government reads the phrase without lawful authority to mean unlawfully used, but that definition would be satisfied virtually every time a predicate crime is committed. And the whole point of the aggravated identity theft statute is to provide additional mandatory punishment only for a subset of those predicate crimes that are committed in a particularly egregious manner. Fourth, the crime is called aggravated identity theft. The important point here is a common sense one. A crime called aggravated identity theft should look like identity theft. It should involve some aspect of stealing or misappropriating someone's identity. The government's alternative construction, by contrast, conflicts with basic principles of statutory interpretation. The government's core position in this case is that the court should isolate the word use and then give that single word its broadest possible dictionary definition. One dictionary definition of the word use is to employ. And with that definition, an aggravated identity theft conviction becomes automatic for anyone who commits healthcare fraud, tax fraud, immigration fraud, or any other type of fraud that involves writing or saying someone else's name. But that untenable result follows only if the word use is read in a vacuum. That's not how courts construe statutes, and that's not how this court should construe the aggravated identity theft statute. The court should reverse on count 25 and remand for resentencing. I'd now like to waive the rest of my uninterrupted time and address any questions that the court might have.
Mr. Zero, this is Judge Higginson.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have just two threshold questions based on the 28 J's that were submitted to us. And I think these are both yes, no answers, but tell me if they're not. Was the 1028 use instruction that was given to this jury a correct statement of law? And if it wasn't, wouldn't you face a McCray obstacle? And the related question is, if you prevail, and this your argument to us, to the full court, is purely a sufficiency argument, can the government still retry your client on the narrowed use theory?
Okay, so taking those in turn, the first answer is yes, I think the instructions were adequate in as much as they merely parroted the statute. It's not a McRae situation where the instruction given was directly contrary to the sufficiency argument being advanced. And on this point, I'd like to make one observation. The government chided us in its opposition brief for advancing a definition of without lawful authority that looked like permission, but the instructions here actually use the word permission to describe without lawful authority. So if there's a McRae issue or a waiver issue, I actually think that would be the government's problem, not ours. And then the second question is about, I believe, the remedy. And I think the remedy would be a judgment of acquittal. The only universe in which it wouldn't be a judgment of acquittal is if the court held that the government's illusory benefits theory was legally viable, factually supported, and then the case would have to be remanded, I suppose, potentially for a retrial on that issue. And the only reason I say potentially is because I think the government would have a statute of limitations problem because it would be required
to... My only follow-up is, you know that at sentencing, when this was argued, the primary argument for your client was, yes, we want a retrial. But now I think the logic of your position that this is a preserved Rule 29, classic sufficiency, this court is actually, as a full court, just reassessing sufficiency, it would mean what you're saying. He couldn't be retried. That's difficult for the government when the government and you, your client, agreed to a broader theory of use. They had go ahead.
Your Honor, I think actually at sentencing, Dubin's counsel asked for a judgment of acquittal on count 25, and it was both a use and during and in relation to argument.
No, I'm just gonna have to disagree. I read that very closely. For the first 5-6 minutes, he was saying, yes, we want retrial. And then it became, maybe it would require a vacating. But the primary argument to the district court was, the record stands for itself, and that's probably not relevant to the full court's decision here.
Right, so either way, I think the important point here is that the court needs to adopt a definition or a construction of the aggravated identity theft statute that reads the statute as a contextual whole, and that gives all the words and phrases within the statute meaning where possible. And I think immediately this is where the government's position runs into trouble. There's obviously the issue with the word use subsuming the word transfer in the statute, but I actually would like to start talking about Yates. I think Yates is a great case just for what type of analysis the court should be performing. So in Yates, there was only one dictionary definition at issue, and that was the one that the government was advancing. And the Supreme Court said, even with that dictionary definition supporting the government's interpretation, we're only going to read this criminal statute to create a vast expansion of federal criminal liability if that dictionary definition is compelled. But in this case, there's actually multiple dictionary definitions of the word use, one of which the government is advancing to the Supreme Court right now in the Van Buren case that supports our position. And this is page 38 of the government's Van Buren brief, but they say that the term use is best understood to require that, and this is in the context of computer fraud, the violator's authorized access be instrumental to acquiring the information. And if that was the definition of use, and I don't think the court should be reading use just by dictionary definitions, but if that was the definition of use that this court adopted, then I believe David Dubin would have to be acquitted. But this is a case where there's multiple dictionary definitions supporting either side.
This is Judge Costa. I have a question. I'm trying to figure out where you're drawing the line between a permissible 1028A prosecution and an impermissible one. Let me give you two hypotheticals. Tell me if they're aggravated identity theft.
Sure.
One, I go to a restaurant, pay with a credit card, and the owner adds a $100 bottle of wine to my tab, and assume that there's fraudulent intent. It's a wire fraud predicate offense. That's hypo one. They add $100 to my tab when they enter my credit card information. Hypo two is they give me the correct charge that evening I go to the restaurant, but then the next night I don't even show up at the restaurant and they run my credit card number through again and charge me for another meal when I'm not there. Ag ID for either of those?
So the second one is certainly aggravated identity theft under the definition we're advancing. The first one, I think, gets the issue is what constitutes a transaction fabricated from whole cloth. That's the line that the cases draw. Judge Elrod's concurrence, also Judge Sutton's opinion in Michael. And I think to answer your question directly, Judge Costa, no, that's not aggravated identity theft. But even if you think adding the bottle of wine, so maybe charging for a separate service, is aggravated identity theft, that's not this case, because the only service that was billed in this case was the service that was actually performed. So this case is just like, I suppose, one of those cases where, to take the overcharging merchant example from the Sixth Circuit, $100 was added to the bill when the value of the service was only 50, something like that, where it's just an overcharge.
So, but why is it ag ID theft then if they charge me the night I'm not there? Is it all about permission? Is it all about whether I'm authorizing them for that transaction to use my identifying information?
So I think it's about two things. One is about permission, and you didn't give permission to bill multiple times. You gave permission to bill in the context of the one meal that you had. And second, when you fabricate a transaction from whole cloth, part of the fraud is misrepresenting who is involved in the transaction. And when you misrepresent who is involved in the transaction, you've used that person's identity in connection with the fraud. So I think it gets at multiple sort of different parts of the statute. And that's exactly where the cases have drawn the line.
This is my last comment. Why it's a hard line for me to see is, aren't you misrepresenting that I had a bottle of wine the night I was actually there?
So you are. It is a misrepresentation that you had a bottle of wine, but I don't think the misrepresentation about your identity is used in connection with the fraud. Who you are as a person is not instrumental to the fraud, and I think that's the reason why. But even if you had a difficult line drawing problem in that case, even if you thought that was aggravated identity theft, this case is different because there was only one service performed and one service billed, and it was the same service. So,
the question was who performed it and were they authorized to perform it at that level? I mean, to me, there are a lot of cases out there that the briefs did not cite. And I have a very difficult time separating without lawful authority from use, because lots of cases talk about there was initial authority to use the identity, but it did not extend to the use that was actually the crime. I have a difficult time making the distinction that you're making.
So I do think, Judge Owen, that you have to read use in light of without lawful authority. I think you're right that there's a lot of cases out there, and they arise in different factual contexts and arguably come at different ways. But if there's a pattern among these cases, it's the pattern that Judge Sutton and Judge Elrod drew about fabricating transactions from whole cloth. And I think if the issue here is a line drawing one, again, I don't think the cases have difficulty drawing the line. In response to Judge Costa's question, I'd direct the court to the Hong case. That sort of looks like your bottle of wine example. That's a Ninth Circuit case, and it was no aggravated identity theft. But the government's construction, especially the illusory benefits theory, has, I think, much worse line drawing problems. I'm not quite sure how one distinguishes between an illusory benefit or a non-illusory benefit, what a jury instruction looks like in that context. And I'll note, coming back to Judge Higginson's question, there was no illusory benefits jury instruction in this case. But so that's one problem. The government's alternative theory has much worse line drawing issues. The government's other construction, I suppose, avoids some line drawing problems, but at the expense of greatly expanding the scope of 1028A, such that any time there's a predicate fraud that involves someone else's name, no matter what the relationship between the underlying fraud and the name, there's aggravated identity theft. So all of the cases see that this is a major problem, and that's why they adopt limiting constructions. And the Supreme Court, in a host of cases, arising of course under different statutes, but say that courts should only adopt a construction of a statute that creates that kind of vast, sweeping expansion of federal criminal liability only when it's absolutely compelled by the statute. And I don't think that's the case here, because there's at least four statutory clues that require a different construction. One is the definition of the word use that the government's advancing in Van Buren. I think that supports us. Two is the during and in relation to language. I think that also supports us. Three is the common sense idea that a statute called aggravated identity theft should look something like aggravated identity theft. And I want to be really clear here. I don't think it actually has to involve theft. If it had to involve theft, I think Congress would have said it. The statutory text is broader than theft, but it's not so broad that it encompasses every single act of predicate fraud that involves someone else's name, no matter how incidental. And the fourth is the without lawful authority thing. And I think going back, Judge Owen, just to your question, I don't think you can separate out each of these individual bits and pieces of the statute and construe them separately and just look them up in a dictionary and see, well, use, the first definition of use is to employ, and therefore it's satisfied here. I don't think that's a fair construction of the statute.
Counsel, you resist the government's definition as employ. What is the definition of use that you want us to adopt for this statute?
Right, so 2 points. The first is, I think the analysis is not quite as simple as adopting a dictionary definition. The word has to be read in the full statutory context. But if the court were to pick a dictionary definition, the dictionary definition would be the one that the government advances in Van Buren, and that's integral to. The use must be integral to the end, and that's the government.
Like, that sounds like a commentary on the in relation to as opposed to use.
So the government is citing there, that is a definition of use from Webster's Third International Dictionary and the Oxford English Dictionary. It's perhaps not the first definition, but it's down the list. But I think that definition of use is actually supported by the during and in relation to language. So I think the government's argument in Van Buren supports our argument here, even if the court were to adopt a dictionary
definition. But what about the Smith case, United States versus Smith, that says in relation to has a very expansive meaning?
It does say in relation to has a very expansive meaning. 2 points on Smith. The first point is the verbs in Smith are different. So this is just talking about use and not during in relation to for the moment. The Smith statute involved use or carry. And I believe it was Bailey, they read use so that it didn't subsume carry. But in this case, we have use and transfer and possess. So it's different verbs, and therefore use has to take on a different meaning because the government's construction of use subsumes transfer. We explained that in our brief. In this regard, I'd also point the court to section 1029. That's the statute after section 1028A. It's got a very similar construction, but it says use, possess, and traffic, and the government's definition of use would also subsume traffic. But that's the first point.
You want us to read use as instrumental to the underlying healthcare fraud.
That's the dictionary definition that we think is correct here.
So my question is, isn't the means of identification here instrumental to the underlying healthcare fraud? In other words, without it, it couldn't happen.
So it is a but-for cause. Without it, it could not happen. But I don't think it's instrumental to the fraud in as much as the underlying fraud does not involve misrepresenting or misappropriating somebody's name. And again,
Mr. Zero, if a but-for connection is sufficient use, is there any, there's almost no healthcare fraud that is excluded from this aggravating penalty, correct?
That's correct. Unless you performed healthcare services on yourself and submitted those to Medicaid or Medicare, every single predicate act of healthcare fraud would be aggravated identity theft. That would also be true for tax preparers who claimed bogus deductions. That would be true for immigration attorneys who lie on immigration forms. And even the cases cited by the government, I'll point the court to Michael and to Gottwas, that was the Eighth Circuit case, say that, for example, a tax preparer who claims a bogus deduction on someone's behalf has not committed aggravated identity theft, even though that person has put the another person's name down on the form. That can't be aggravated identity theft, even under the cases that the government is citing. So the question,
can you address the Spears case and the approach that Judge Easterbrook takes that deals with beyond the scope of permission, which is a different way of trying to skin this cat?
Yes, Judge Elrod. It is a different way of getting to the same end result. You see that actually in the Ninth Circuit case. Judge Friedland's concurrence says essentially this construction of use during and in relation to and also without lawful authority are ending up at the same place. And I see my time is running out. May I answer the question in full?
Yes.
Thank you. Ultimately, what courts are struggling with is the government's construction of the statute gives rise to a sweeping expansion of criminal liability in every circumstance in which someone else's name is spoken or written during a fraud. And so there's multiple different statutory levers that all sort of pull in the same direction. And so I think this is just like one of those Supreme Court cases where the Supreme Court says, unless this overbroad construction is absolutely required by the text, the court has to adopt a narrow definition. And I think that's what the court should do here.
All right, thank you. Go ahead, Judge Ellen.
Well, does it matter what the use is, whether the use is broad or narrow, if it's not beyond the scope of permission?
No, it doesn't. If you
find... We don't have to quibble on the use definition then, if you could use even the use definition used by the majority.
You could. If you find that that the use here was with lawful authority, then you would also have to enter a judgment of acquittal.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Mr. Alonso.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Alonso. I represent the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers as amicus. The NACDL is here today because of its continuing and serious concern about overcriminalization in the federal system. And we just think this case is just the latest example of the government's expansive reading of expansive statutes that were passed at its instance with language that, unless you consider it in context, will lead to expansive interpretations of federal jurisdiction that were never intended by Congress or even by DOJ itself, right? I mean, when DOJ talked about this statute at the time of its passing and even today, it talks about sort of very narrow concepts of identity theft, and then we have broad applications like that today and like that of we've seen in some of the other cases. And we have the same concern that was expressed by the appellant's counsel that the government's expansive reading would turn essentially all garden variety frauds into identity theft cases that require a mandatory additional 2 years in prison. So obviously we have seen in recent years that the Supreme Court has tried to put a stop to this in a variety of contexts, in Yates, McDonald, Kelly, Bond, Marinello. These are our recent examples where this kind of thing keeps happening. So as we turn to the application of that problem in the context of 1028A, we have the problem that the statute as passed is all about identity theft. And this is not that. This is a healthcare fraud case. It's a healthcare fraud case in the hundreds of dollars, which had it been prosecuted in Texas State.
Mr. Alonso?
Yes, sir.
Your time's short. I'd be very interested in the NACDL's view of the procedural posture allowing us to get at defining the scope of 1028 here. In other words, if the objection wasn't made pre-trial, allowing the government to appeal a dismissal, wasn't then made in the specific Rule 29 motion, was not made in the Rule 30 instructional motion, do you agree with co-counsel that by allowing a defendant to bring it up at sentencing through a motion to reconsider, that means the government cannot retry? Do you agree with that? If this is a sufficiency, yes, you do.
Yeah, this is a sufficiency.
And you think that's the rule of law for all defendants going forward? If they can get a district judge to entertain a new legal theory or an untimely sufficiency theory, then on that new theory drawn from another circuit, there's no way for the government or the district court to correct it.
Right now, I'd like to limit that to this case. But yes, I do think that the sufficiency issue was raised. I also think it goes beyond that, right? The government's saying that the appellant can't talk about the phrase without lawful authority because they didn't specifically challenge that. I think it goes back to the question of context, right? The question before this en banc court is to interpret the word use, but you, of course—
Right, but our authority, en banc authority, Herrera, if you make a specific Rule 29, and this one was 10, 20 pages long, but you don't make the argument you make later, you are subject to plain error review.
Judge, plain error review, I don't think really hurts the appellant in this case in any event.
But what I'm not asking whether it hurts him. Do you agree with me that law compels here plain air review?
Judge, I'm not familiar with the ins and outs of your precedent enough to tell you that. So okay. I apologize.
That's fine.
But I do think that plain air review, this is statutory interpretation. You are interpreting this statute de novo in any event. And so you have to, the task before the court is to decide what use means without lawful authority as part of the context of what use means here. So I do think you have the textual basis from this statute to interpret the case to mean when identities are stolen, which is the definition we would put on this, because it's supported both by the concept of without lawful authority and the much narrower reading of use that the Ninth Circuit, the First Circuit, and the Sixth Circuit have put forward, because you don't want to render.
If plain error review applies, the error would have to be a plain under the second prong, but you're telling us it's a res nova issue, so the error could not have been plain.
The error here, if the statute says what the appellant says it says and what we are urging the court, then the error, I believe, could be plain. I don't think they are, they are defeated simply by forfeiture because of plain error review, because you are reviewing the statute de novo. And to do that, you look at the context, and here you've got textual basis. I see my time is up. May I complete my answer? You've got the textual basis, which is the fact that use cannot have an expansive meaning like the government says, because transfer would otherwise be superfluous. And then without lawful authority is what gives play to what Congress's intent and DOJ's intent was here in the first place.
So all statutory errors are plain.
Judge, I'm not prepared to go that far.
Mr. Alonzo, at oral argument, I believe, Dubin's counsel conceded that the use was without lawful authority. Are you familiar with that?
At oral argument, are you saying in the district court or in the panel?
Before our court.
Before the en banc court?
Without lawful authority. The panel opinion made that point, that right. It was conceded that the use was, quote, without lawful authority.
Right, and we do not agree with that, Your Honor. We believe that...
Well, wait. Your counsel conceded that. You can't say you disagree with it. Dubin's first counsel, we're now on counsel number three in this case. They switch with every level of this appeal. But the counsel at oral argument to our panel conceded the use was without lawful authority. That's binding.
Your Honor, respectfully, the NACDL believes that without lawful authority has to have some meaning. And it can't just mean that it's being used in a crime, because by definition, every single use here is going to be used in a crime. So without lawful authority under that reading would be completely rendered superfluous. We believe without lawful authority means that there's a victim of identity theft. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Engelhardt. Would you add 3 minutes to the government's time?
May it please the court, Elizabeth Berenger from the Western District of Texas on behalf of the United States. This case involves the straightforward application of legal terms with plain and settled meanings. Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, David Dubin's conduct in this case falls squarely within the plain meaning of the statute. Dubin used patient L's identity information, or his PII, when he submitted a fraudulent claim for services that he did not provide. To resolve this case, this court does not need to adopt a maximalist interpretation of the statute, nor does it need to create a split from the other circuits. And actually, this case is not really that great a vehicle to make a far-reaching pronouncement about the outer edges and contours of 1028A. And that's true for two reasons. The first is that there's no strong textual hook for the proposed carve out. When I am listening to what the defendant is proposing, it's when the predicate fraud involves misappropriating identity. And that goes to the nature of the fraud. It doesn't go to the plain meaning of the term use. And the second reason that this case is not really a great vehicle is that even under the defendant's proposed interpretation, the evidence was sufficient in this case. Under every circuit's interpretation of the statute, using a patient's PII to make a false claim for services that the provider does not provide is aggravated identity theft. The defendant filed a false claim for a fictitious appointment for services that were not provided. And also, this is plain misappropriation. I think as Judge Costa's question suggests, using identity information like a credit card to access an insured's benefits, that's theft by conversion. That's misappropriation under any definition of misappropriation. So the court can reserve the question of the more difficult cases raised by both the amicus and the defendant and the other circuits in a different case in which that case is presented squarely and not really this case in the way that it has arisen. And I'm happy.
Let me ask you, am I correct of the 2 minutes is what you reserved? I think yes. We just asked yes. That. We have a statute that incorporates 11 different felonies, all of which would have this same definition applied to it. I heard some from Mr. Zorro about how he thinks this affects some of the others. A concern we need to have is however we define use for purposes of healthcare fraud, to the extent the crimes themselves don't force a different definition. Those also have to apply to the other crimes as well, the other felony offenses. Have you thought through that at all? Does the definitions being proposed here have particular effects on the other felony offenses that are maybe even clearer than their effects here?
I agree that concern that if we create sort of a carved out exception for provider payment fraud, that will definitely have a ripple effect to other cases that are not presented here. For instance, there are cases in identity fraud that deal with immigration attorneys filing hundreds of repeated asylum cases. And if we have this sort of carve out for services versus non-services, like how would we ever do that? The variety of misconduct that happens in these fraud statutes is just extremely wide. We can't even think of the hypotheticals that would happen. And whether it depends on the kind of fraud you commit, whether you commit this kind of fraud or this kind of fraud, that's not what the statute's targeting. The statute's targeting the use of the PII in relation to the fraud. It sort of operates, as Judge Sutton recognized and Michael, as a sentencing enhancement statute.
Can I just pick up on that, counsel? I don't mean to interrupt, but this case is about whether the use of the means of identification was in relation to a specific statute, right? 1347 is the one that I see. Is that right? Healthcare fraud, 1347?
Yes, Your Honor. Healthcare fraud or healthcare fraud conspiracy.
Right, I understand it, but the conspiracy is parasitic on 1347. So 1347A2 says you commit the crime by obtaining by means of false or fraudulent pretenses, representations, or promises any of the money in a healthcare program, right? That's what it says. So my question is, what are the false or fraudulent representations here that underline the healthcare fraud? Does it have to do with the means of identification, or does it have to do with something else?
Well, the means of identification is only relevant to the extent that I can think of in the 1028 context. The fraud itself,
The underlying fraud itself
was based on several misrepresentations. One, the purely fictitious date, no services were provided in May. Second, that these services were not provided by a licensed psychologist as they were claimed. Three, that there was overbilling happening, that he billed for 3 instead of 2.5 hours. So that, and then that there was no testing provided. That was the government's theory charged in the indictment and argued at closing argument.
Okay, so that's my understanding too. So none of those involve misrepresentations about the means of identification. So is that a problem for applying 1028A?
Well, the statute doesn't look to what the specifics of the fraud were. That would be important.
It says it has to be in relation to the underlying fraud.
Yes, in relation to. So just to address that nexus, first, I mean, I can't go talk about the nexus without saying that this is the first time that we're dealing with the nexus on banc review. It was waived before the panel. It wasn't raised below other than in the motion to reconsider. So that issue, a challenge to the sufficiency of the nexus element, has been waived. There was even a question at oral argument. Judge Ho says, what's your textual hook for your argument? Is it use? And defense counsel says, that's certainly that I don't want to take it out of context, but says, absolutely, that's my, I'm only challenging element one.
Okay. So we were only- Ms. Berenger, we're interpreting the statute. So as the court, we can interpret it as we think best.
I completely agree with you. There is
that's not a waiver.
I respectfully disagree with that in the context of a sufficiency challenge. When someone under Herrera only challenges a specific element, that is the element that they're raising on appeal. They don't just get to say, well, because I raised one specific element, I'm challenged the entire statute. But I mean, we can respectfully disagree on that issue.
Well, Ms. Berenger, on that issue, if in fact our court were to allow them to bring up a new legal theory, do you agree with defense counsel, both defense counsel, that you would not be able to retry them on the theory that they've come up with after verdict and jeopardy have attached?
So a defendant
therefore could bring up a totally new theory from another circuit after jeopardy is attached, and you would not be able to retry. Do you agree that's the logic?
I agree.
So that makes me very baffled why you didn't object at sentencing. Now that's the heat of the moment maybe, but it was a motion to reconsider. And then especially the government compounded it to the panel when it didn't allege plain error. So the question I have for you is Rule 52 non-jurisdictional as a procedural default rule, one that the government can waive? Yes or no?
The government cannot waive or concede the standard of review. I don't think that, so the Eberhardt issue is whether the defendant can raise that sort of motion when there's an inflexible rule in existence, but it doesn't necessarily make that claim timely, and it doesn't necessarily determine what the standard of review is for that claim. So the best I can say is that is an unanswered question. I couldn't find any precedent that directly addresses that point after Eberhardt.
Thank you.
Well, in Eberhardt, obviously there is a Rule 33 motion. It's untimely, but there is a motion. Whereas here, there, as I understand it, there's no Rule 29 motion on this ground. So I guess my question is the government aware of a case where a federal criminal defendant received a judgment of acquittal without ever moving under Rule 29 on that ground?
To be fair to the defendant, my interpretation of that motion to reconsider would be a motion to reconsider the Rule 29. So I don't know if you can raise an untimely Rule 29 in a motion to reconsider. That's an open question.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I just think that these are sort of uncharted territories. I could not find cases that are directly a point. I found cases post Carlisle, but not post Eberhardt. So that sort of makes it difficult because.
I don't mean to interrupt.
You go ahead, Judge Jones.
Well, Ms. Berenger, I know for a fact, because I wrote an opinion on this, that in the civil context, a district court has latitude in a reconsideration motion, the district court has discretion to take up an additional issue. Most of the time they choose not to do it. Obviously the district court here was very concerned because the discussion of this issue went on for multiple pages of the transcript. I do not see how anyone can legitimately argue this is not before us.
I also think that the fact that this is not being raised to the en banc weighs in favor in this case, maybe not in other cases, of the fact of applying de novo review. But regardless of the standard of review here, I do want to address the nexus element because even if it's a plain error, even if it's waived, I do think it's important in this case to show that we know what that in relation to means because Smith told us. Smith was interpreting a very similar statute, 924C, which has the same use and during and in relation to, and it says it must have some purpose or effect with respect to the crime. It cannot be the result of accident or coincidence. It facilitates or has the potential to facilitate. Here, the use of the PII was the very means by which the crime was committed. It's he couldn't use it without it. I think as Judge Duncan noticed, it's the mode of the healthcare fraud. This both satisfies the test in Smith, and there's a great case from the Sixth Circuit called Mobley that is sort of talking about bank fraud and the use of Social Security information to commit the fraud, and finds it satisfies the Smith test. I do want to address that both the amicus
before you get
and-
to that, before you get to your next point, I want to circle back to whether the issue was raised properly. As I read the record, it was not raised at the close of the government's case in chief. After Dubin, both Dubins testified and put on other evidence, it was not raised at the close of Dubin's case, other than they said, we readopt what we said at the close of the government's case, which is insufficient. It was not raised in the motion for new trial filed 14 days after trial ended. It was first raised in a motion to reconsider 10 months after trial. Is that your understanding of the record?
Yes, use theory. 6 months after trial, yes.
The use theory was not raised until a motion to reconsider, when the point wasn't even raised in whatever is supposed to be reconsidered. It was a brand new point. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And I just want to address the little incidental language that keeps popping up. That first came out in a case called Gatwiss. It was a government's response during oral argument where the government agreed that it must be more than incidental to the crime. But that is just a very imprecise term that is not consistent with Smith. Incidental, I think, is getting confused with coincidental. And coincidental, of course, means by chance, and incidental means small. And I think it's sort of confusing like a gravamen of the crime or like a proximate cause element with what is really a very broad connection in Smith.
Go ahead, sorry.
I wanted to follow up on Judge Southwick's question about other context and the defense counsel's argument about the tax context, that if a tax provider used the ID to give you an extra benefit, that wouldn't be aggravated identity theft. Can you, why isn't that similar? And how does your definition not bleed into that and cause a conflict there? And then my second question is it true that in the First and the Sixth and the Ninth Circuits, at least, the outcome here would be different?
Okay, to sort of adopt, and then don't let me forget about that second question, Judge Elrod, because I think I may get off track here. But as far as the tax preparer ones, I do think that it would be a tough case. But if someone claims a deduction and they use PII in relation to a fraud without lawful authority, if that tax preparer situation fit within the plain meaning of the statute, I would have to say, yes, the evidence would be sufficient. But that is a very different question from prosecutorial discretion. Should that case be brought? No, I would not want to defend that case. But that's not what we're evaluating here, is whether a prosecutor should or should not bring a case under a statute. It's whether the evidence was sufficient under the statute. And so, I just want to say, like, we're thinking of this sort of individual taxpayer, you know, tax preparer, this poor taxpayer who gets charged with federal charges and a 2-year mandatory minimum. But the kinds of cases that arise in the tax context are these SURF cases. I don't know if any of you have encountered these. They're these stolen identity refund fraud cases where there's these massive criminal organizations and they go into like prisons and convalescent hospitals, and they have willing participants that they sell drugs for people's identity information, and they just file these massive fraud tax refunds. And you know what? Every single one of those indictments has a substantive tax offense, and it has a 1028 charge. And I couldn't even find a case during sort of a cursory search of someone challenging the sufficiency of that case. It's so uncontroversial to charge that tax preparer with the 1028 charge. If you go on the IRS website, they list like 100 cases where they have, I mean, I might be exaggerating here, there's scores of cases where this has happened. So I think when we think, whenever we think about these hypotheticals, and that is why this case is not really a great vehicle for determining the outer edges of the statute. We need to wait for a case where there's the tax preparer and just really see what's going on, like what is happening in that case, because—
Ms. Feringer, I don't think I've heard any member of this court question the cognizability of 1028 in that context. I think that's a straw man on your part.
There are SERP cases out there. So another instance is, attacking, this is a trap in the same argument was sort of raised in the context of Muscarello. It's sort of a related point where that's the case that Justice Breyer writing for the court is addressing the carry versus use of the firearm statute, that when we start making these broad carve out exceptions based on the case before us, you know, are we really gonna import a carry on the person requirement when we're thinking of a small arms case? Well, what about the case where someone has like a bazooka and they can't possibly carry it on themselves? Like it's hard to address and carve out these exceptions like Judge Southwick was pointing at, that these sometimes impact cases like WED, or they impact wire fraud in cases that we don't really anticipate when we sort of add these non-textual carve outs to the statute. And I do want to—
The first, sixth and ninth circuits, and since I'm re-asking the question, I'm gonna ask you to also address Judge Easterbrook's approach in Spears.
Okay, well, I'm not sure. Well, let me first get to the first, second. Under all of those circuits, this conviction would stand. And the reason is that the defendant filed a false claim for services that he never provided. It can be distinguished from a case like, especially I think Hong and Michael, especially because those are not the latest statement that were made by the
test, didn't he? He got the gentleman, patient L got the test. It just got, he got it a different time and he got it by a different provider, but he got the test, at least part of the test.
Well, that question seems to go to whether there was a healthcare fraud at all and not whether there was a 1028 conviction, whether the sufficiency
of 1028. I thought your question was going to say he didn't get the services, and I thought it's pretty clear he did get the services. It's just the date and the provider of the service that are at issue. So I'm sorry, go ahead and answer the question. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
You didn't interrupt me. I'm sorry. I maybe was not addressing your question directly, and I want to. The question about the services that were provided in this case. So the government's position is that there were no services provided. They billed for a purely fictitious appointment that never occurred. There was no appointment in May. There was no services provided by a licensed psychologist. Now, I know, Judge Elrod, your question sort of gets at the heart of, hey, they did provide this LPA. He kind of did something where he did an evaluation. So doesn't that count? And I think that question goes to the sufficiency of the healthcare fraud, not the use of the PII in connection with that fraud. But I also want to address that point because I don't believe that these facts have been fully put forth, and that there was no Medicare eligible testing that occurred in this case. Even though an LPA can provide services at a lower rate, they cannot provide them under the circumstances that happen in this case. One, Medicaid requires that the LPA be an employee of the organization. Two, they have to be directly supervised by a licensed psychologist, which means the licensed psychologist is in the building and immediately available. And it's a fair reading of the record to show that neither of those two requirements were met in this case. And it's not just a mere technicality, like, why is Medicaid doing this? Why are they making these crazy requirements? These rules serve as a proxy to make sure that the indigent children who are covered by Medicaid get a certain level and minimum level of service. Like this is not like Hong or Medlock, where you're just like, you know, a teenager could drive somebody to the hospital or somebody could provide a massage. This is an opinion about someone's mental state. I mean, this is a serious service. You don't want like a medical student performing a heart surgery. you don't want an unlicensed person performing these kinds of services. So I do think that the government's position that there were no services are provided is first for there no being appointment, and second, because what was provided was not really what was being provided to the child. But even if we dig deeper into that fraud, there's really no services being provided here. They were abandoned before they were performed. I mean, there's just so much in the scope of where you go down the thread of what was provided here.
Ms. Berenger?
Yes.
Can I ask you this? So 1028A, as I understand it, is supposed to add some culpability. It adds a mandatory 2 years, right, to the underlying healthcare fraud. So I take that to mean it's supposed to add something. So my one concern I have is, when I look at the underlying fraud, which is 1347, tell me how you can commit a 1347A2 healthcare fraud without always committing a 1028A means of identification misuse.
So under the textual approach taken by the panel, there, if you use someone's PII, and you have to, then all of those cases are going to be aggravated identity theft. It doesn't mean all healthcare fraud, of course. You're talking about.
So that's my question. Not start with 1347. Tell me how someone violates 1347A2 and not commit a 1028A misuse of means of identification.
I believe that they would violate the plain text of the statute if in every case.
In fact,
I'm talking about the provider payment context. I'm really sorry. I do not have my statute book. It's one of the many things covering my desk right now.
What if the patient was complicit? I'm sorry.
Didn't you, in fact, argue to the jury precisely that every use of a person's identity is equivalent to a violation of this statute?
Well, that's not exactly what we argued. I direct the court's attention to 487.
I'm paraphrasing.
The prosecutor also did argue that it had to facilitate the fraud, which I think is an important distinction. But the government's not wrong here. When the way that you commit your fraudulent crime is to use someone's means of identification, that falls within the sentencing statute. I mean, what else can there to say?
What about a situation where the patient is complicit, like a kickback type scenario?
Yeah.
The courts have found that a willing patient is not an exception. It still falls within the meaning of without lawful authority. But again, the court does not need to address that particular issue because there's no evidence that, I mean, this was not a willing participant. So I understand that being a case for a future case where that might be an issue, and that might be a separate question, but I do think that the courts have approved of these willing participant cases. I mean, it's a broad statute, and I don't disagree. This is a broad statute, just like mine.
I wonder if the problem here is just without lawful authority should be, and maybe I'm just totally wrong about this, without lawful authority presumably means without the permission of the person. And so maybe those cases are wrong, but the panel basically got it right.
Well, I think that reading, Judge Ho, is consistent with Mahmood. I think that's what the court found in Mahmood. So I think that's what our circuit said. I don't think that our circuit has really been confronted with sort of the willing participant predicament yet. I haven't seen
just
it.
That's another way in which other circuits are wrong.
I disagree with that. I sat on a healthcare fraud case a few years ago where there was a clinic in Houston that was busing in people at the rate of 100, sort of like illegal immigrants, a rate of 100 a day or more, and purporting to examine them and claiming Medicare for every one of them. And they were paying them money while they bused them. And guess what? We all held they were liable. Now, I personally think that would have also involved aggravated identity theft because, of course, the services provided were a joke. It was all, fraud from beginning to end.
That's consistent with the Second Circuit's decision in Demetrio. There was an asylum lawyer that was sort of recycling these asylum narratives, and they affirmed the 1028 conviction in that case. Judge Duncan, I'm not sure if I thoroughly answered the question.
Well,
that you had.
I mean, not really. I mean, if you're being candid and you say every time somebody commits a 1347A2 healthcare fraud, they also commit aggravated identity theft. Okay. That doesn't, I mean, that's a problem, I think, for your interpretation of the statute, if that is in fact the case.
I apologize that I am only talking about provider payment. And so if there's a situation that I'm not thinking in A2, then that would not qualify. So if this is a provider payment, like making a false claim is what I'm talking about. Is it the use of the means of identification in relation to the fraud? That's the plain meaning. I don't know what other answer to give you other than that's what Congress has decided. And is it broad? Yes, it's broad.
But if the patient is totally complicit, I mean, I've never heard of an ID theft case where the person's ID is willingly given over. That's not
actually
theft.
There are cases where defendants have bought a passport, for example. There are several cases where the person gave their ID willingly, and it was still held to be an aggravated theft violation.
I mean, maybe that I'm wrong. That sounds weird to me.
I do think that the willing.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just said that the willing participant cases is really, I haven't seen us confront it in the 1028 context and the healthcare fraud context in this circuit yet. And I haven't really seen healthcare fraud willing participant cases that I can think of off the top of my head. So usually what Judge Owen is saying is it's usually in the context of people giving identity documents, immigration documents is where that comes up.
Right. And I think we've had all these different contexts in our circuit already. But what do you do? We still haven't talked about did he use beyond the scope of the permission, which is the question that Judge Easterbrook asked in the Spears case. Who does not consent to the use of the means of identification. That's how he phrases it. And he talks about use beyond the scope of the permission. And that's how he distinguishes the situation. And I've asked you to discuss that case, and I wish you could. And also, can you discuss the government's take in Van Buren and whether the government is taking inconsistent positions?
Well, first, I can't speak to the government's position in Van Buren. I'm not familiar with it enough to do that, so I apologize for that. But as far as the interpretation that Spears took of another person, you know, no one has really joined that. And I think that opinion is sort of limited to its sort of unusual facts, where it was a transfer case and the PII that was being transferred is it's being transferred back to the person who those are their identity documents. So it's sort of an unusual opinion, and I think people cite the language of it, but even that court has not really continued to go with that theory over time. But I think what you're getting at, Judge Elrod, is beyond the scope of permission. I think that's Mahmoud. I think that's this case. The evidence, a reasonable construction of the evidence is that the patient L did not give permission for these services. So I don't really think that that's the issue that's present in this case. Let's make sure I've covered some of the points I want to make. I did want to talk about the congressional purpose of the statute just for a second, in case anybody wants to interrupt with other questions. That's fine. That this crime does fall within the congressional, the purpose of the statute. And we were talking about, you know, the breadth of this statute. It's not a breadth that's present here, but the statute's addressed, it's sort of the evils of people using PII to commit certain crimes. And it adds a +2 when people use PII. And the court recognized that there's this sort of special harm that happens when people use PII, this reputational harm to the victim that's like sort of tough to dial back once it's been cast. And it enacted a broad statute with broad language to sort of address that harm. And here, the harm to the to the victim, patient L, is the very same evil that is addressed by the statute. You know, the defendant used this high-risk kid's personal identity information to bill for services that were never provided to him, never completed. He never got an evaluation. He was discharged from the facility by the time they were even charged to him. And this kid had psychological problems. And the crime, the use of his PII, exposed him to the very real risk that he would be denied future services because his benefits had been exhausted. So this is the very type of statute, unlike Yates, where some of the other bond cases, where they're kind of sort of wildly beyond sort of what the statute was targeting. And this,
all that makes sense and would not apply if the person were willing. They wouldn't be a victim then, they'd be a participant.
I can't.
I'm just thinking that may answer Judge Duncan's question about, is there a gap between this statute and healthcare fraud?
Again, I can only speak to provider payment fraud. I'm worried that there's sort of something I'm missing in that statute that would
the
not.
The government may not embrace this theory, but it is a theory that may be responsive to Judge Duncan, whether the government likes it or not.
I think that the cases have uniformly held that the willing participant can still fall within the scope of the statute. But again, this court does not need to reach that question in this case. So let me just make sure I address all the questions that have come up. I apologize, just a moment. If the court does not have any questions, I would just like to reiterate that in sum, David Dubin used a former patient's identity information to fraudulently get Medicaid dollars. This is heartland conduct under the statute. And the government would ask that the panel opinion actually be reinstated. We feel like it's the best view of the law that applies the plain meaning and distinguishes outside cases. I see my time has expired. I would ask you to affirm the judgment.
Mr. Zarrow.
Thank you. In my short time, I'd like to make 4 points, one procedural, one factual, one legal, and one practical. So the procedural point in response to Judge Higginson's question, if you look at the plain language of Rule 52B, it says that an issue needs to be brought to the court's attention. These issues were brought to the district court's attention. The government could have objected as untimely. Had they done so, the issue would not have been considered at all, but the government forfeited that argument under Eberhardt. In response, I believe it was to Judge Barksdale's question.
How can the government forfeit an argument when the argument being made is too late in the case?
Because timeliness is non-jurisdictional, and a timeliness argument can be waived.
So you're wiping out the requirements of Rule 29 about when a Rule 29 motion is supposed to be made. You're saying that as Judge Higginson pointed out, under your theory, you cannot make one at the close of the government's case. You cannot make one at the close of your evidence, therefore not allowing the government to put on rebuttal evidence. You cannot make one after the close of trial. You can wait until right at sentencing and then raise a new point. That's your argument, isn't it?
So long as the government objects, we can't do that. That's what the Eberhardt case says. So long as the government objects, we cannot do that. But
Eberhardt dealt with a time limit, 7 days, under a motion for new trial. It's totally different from this case.
Eberhardt says Rule 29's time limits are non-jurisdictional, and non-jurisdictional arguments can be waived. Judge Barksdale, in response to your question about argument at the panel, I have 2 points. One is this court is construing the statute as a whole. The second is that particular argument was foreclosed by Mahmoud. Now this court is sitting on bonk, so there's no precedent standing in the way. To the factual point I'd like to make, real testing services were provided. In response to the government's exchange with Judge Duncan, I think it's pretty clear that the underlying fraud here involved a misrepresentation about when, or a misrepresentation about the value of the services, but there was real testing that was done, and only that testing was billed. So the argument that this is just like those other cases where no service was provided is factually incorrect. I think the record on that point speaks for itself. This case is just like the first, Sixth, and Ninth Circuit cases that Judge Elrod was referencing. There were real services provided.
Related to the procedural point, sorry.
Would we have to overrule Mahmood in this case?
So Mahmood is only with about without lawful authority. If you agree
actually, with read it is not. It talks about use in connection with unlawful authority, but it does not divorce the two.
Right. Yes. To answer your question directly, yes, I think Mahmood is not correct and not consistent with our interpretation or the interpretation of the First, Sixth, Ninth Circuit, and also with statements in the Eighth Circuit, Second Circuit, all of the cases we cited in our reply brief.
Can I go back briefly to the procedural point?
Sure.
Specifically, your notion that the government forfeited any forfeiture argument.
Yeah.
How does that interact with the principle that we can affirm for any basis available?
I don't think that's available in the criminal context. Not when there's a sufficiency challenge, because there's a due process right and a jury trial right. So if you're going to affirm, at least on a ground that wasn't presented
to the jury. Oh, I thought the concern here was that there was no such motion. But anyway, I'll let you go.
Thank you. So the legal point, we're not asking for a carve out from the statute. I don't fully understand the argument, but I do think the government conceded in its argument in opposition that they're asking for an extremely broad construction of Section 1028A. And as I understand their response is, well, we're gonna use our discretion and not bring fringe cases. And I think this is a fringe case. Just trust us. We're not gonna over-prosecute Section 1028A. But that type of argument was expressly rejected by the Supreme Court in Marinello. There's just no question that that's not an argument available to the government. And the fourth point, and this is about the Supreme Court cases. When a court is considering a statute like this one, and the government is advancing an extremely broad construction based only on the dictionary definitions, in this case of one term, one single term, the Supreme Court cases all say this court should adopt a narrower construction unless the government's reading is absolutely compelled by the statute. And it's not compelled by the statute here. On the contrary, context, all the things we've been talking about throughout, require rejecting the government's interpretation. And for that reason, we'd ask the court to reverse and to remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We have your arguments. This case will be under submission. The court will take a brief recess between this